Ms. Lesk, I have seen increasing interest among non-resident aliens in creating trusts in this country. What is driving this interest? Do different considerations apply if an NRA has U.S. beneficiaries or if he or she might emigrate to the U.S.? What features are important to NRAs in selecting a state to house their trusts?
Well, historically, the two major reasons for NRAs to create U.S. trusts was either because they had U.S. beneficiaries and wanted to avoid accumulated income charges down the road, or because they were planning to migrate to the United States and wanted to get assets out of their estates, although they were willing to pay income tax for the privilege of having some access to them during the rest of their life. What has expanded the market for U.S. trusts, and here I'm using U.S. trusts actually in the non-technical sense, a trust governed by United States law, because one of the big things that's happened is that we now know, since 1996, we've been able to tell with certainty whether a trust for purposes of the Internal Revenue Code is a foreign trust or a U.S. trust. And it is easy, reliable, safe to create a foreign trust that's governed by the law of a state of the United States. So this didn't used to be the case. I mean, you used to sit there balancing center of gravity test factors that were very murky with not a whole lot of case law and saying, well, maybe if a majority of the trustees are here or there, it'll be U.S. or foreign. Now you know. It's very clear. It's a very bright line. And that means you can create a trust that's governed by the law of Delaware, say, that will not be subject to U.S. income taxes unless it has U.S. source income or U.S. assets. And consequently, you can take advantage of stability and financial institutions in the United States without necessarily exposing yourself to the whole U.S. tax regime. At the same time, there have been developments on the state and international level that fed into this. On the state level, you've had a number of states that have really overhauled their trust codes in order to make them more attractive as a trust situs, either by repealing effectively the rule against perpetuities, by enacting asset protection provisions, by putting in up-to-date administrative provisions, allowing protection for fiduciaries where you have split responsibility, where you have one trustee that's your investment trustee, one that's your distribution, allowing for investment advisors, trust protectors, so that now there are many features which used to be primarily available offshore that are now sanctioned by statute in jurisdictions with recognized standing in the U.S. The last thing that happened was internationally, and we had some states, countries that created blacklists for their residents and said, we are going to either impose special reporting requirements or in some cases taxes or in some cases simply hassle and scrutiny if you are a beneficiary of or create trusts in jurisdictions that we consider tax havens. And this has been primarily a South American phenomenon. Brazil, Venezuela, Argentina are all in that category. Mexico had some similar restrictions which have been modified. But because of that, clients who are resident in those jurisdictions that want to have money administered elsewhere, possibly because they want bolt hole money, you know, money that they consider to be safe even if there's a major political or economic change in their home jurisdiction, can go to the U.S. because it's not on any of the blacklists, whereas if they go to many of the usual suspect tax havens, they will encounter problems at home. When you put all of this together, NRAs can use trust created under the laws of a U.S. state without U.S. hassle, with the advantages of our financial institutions. In some cases, residents of high-tax jurisdiction with favorable treaties with the U.S. may even decide that they want to create a trust that will be a U.S. trust under the code, pay their income taxes here, and get treaty protection against taxes at home. In some instances, putting assets in a trust governed by U.S. law will protect against forced heirship provisions in home jurisdictions governed by civil law. And Warren Whitaker recently suggested that all of this also makes it possible for NRAs to hold U.S. situs assets through U.S. trusts and get the same kind of protection against U.S. estate tax inclusion that they've usually traditionally relied on foreign corporations for.
Mr. Hastings, but plans still need to be developed and wills and trusts still need to be written. How do you see this work being done in the future?
This is the question where I'm certain to offend somebody in the audience. But I guess the first thing is to test the validity of the premise. Is it true that fewer young people are coming into the field? It seems to be true to me, but one always has to ask, is it one's own particular situation that is biasing one, or is coloring one's perspective? I come, you know, big firm, New York City perspective. It certainly seems to me that fewer young attorneys, and I would say without... not that we don't get good people occasionally, but I would say on balance, fewer of the best and the brightest law school graduates are coming into the field. Now, maybe that's not true in Nebraska. I don't know. Maybe it's not true beyond the walls of the big firms. Certainly, I think in New York City, at least, and in my professional life, I can identify three reasons why we're getting fewer good people. One is that... just the T&E practice has declined in the big firms in New York City, without question. I mean, departments, once formidable departments, have been shrunk or even eliminated, and firms that were once well-known for their T&E practice are gone. The best law school graduates often come to New York and start their careers anyway in big firms, and they're not seeing as much opportunity in the trust and estates area, and so they don't get into it as much. That's been true for a long time. Secondly, I think everyone will have noticed that lawyers no longer are the most highly compensated people on the block. It's incredible to think, but when I started practicing in New York City 30 years ago, if you went into a meeting and there was a partner from your law firm and a partner from some Wall Street house, you could pretty much anticipate that they both had about the same income. Well, it's just completely and totally different. Now, lawyers don't make, you just can't render a service and charge by the hour and make as much money as you do as a hedge fund manager. It just doesn't work that way. Now, students noticed this, and I think it resulted in the 1990s in a sort of general decline in the quality of students going to law school they went to business school instead. That kind of changed, I have a sense, when the tech bubble burst 6 years ago, people remembered for the first time in a decade and a half that things could go down as well as up. But I still think that many young lawyers today who are starting their career in the law want to be in a position, perhaps, to jump into the financial sector. Many of the exit emails that I see at Skadden are not about people going to another law firm, but people are going off to the ABC Capital Management, blah, 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 and they've left the law. Now, T&E does not offer the best platform. You don't develop the best network of contacts and so on for making that jump. I think that's a second reason. I think a third reason has been the possible repeal of the federal estate tax, which was seen as sinking the field. And although I don't think it would sink the field, it would make it less intellectually interesting. It would be much harder to say that it was a fully intellectually satisfying field if there were no estate tax. Now, that maybe will reverse itself. And won't be a factor in future years. I don't know, as the prospect of repeal seems to recede. The result, in my observation, has been a kind of graying of the trust and estates department, sort of like the graying of America. And there's a lot of gray hair where there is hair in this room. Not that there aren't some young faces out there as well. And thank heavens that there are. But It has produced a division of work within the trust and estates field that is much different than it was when I started practicing 30 years ago. What the 50-something and 60-something lawyers do today is much different than what they were doing then. And what they're doing today is that you remain hands-on throughout your professional life. You remain current with developments. You draft. You do, at least in my experience, we're all more hands-on than we thought we might be as the 50s roll on into the 60s. There are fewer associates. There's average T&E department is not. It's not. Not only is it not pyramidal, it's not even rectangular anymore. It's likely to be a reverse pyramid. Not always, and these are not inevitable. And I don't know that it will stay this way forever. But in the meantime, it makes it more difficult, I think, to get the work out. I don't have any. The question really is, how do we get the work out under these circumstances? I don't have any comprehensive solution to that. I do think that technology can be invoked in a way that helps. And the primary, what we have done at Skadden, is to go whole hog with document assembly. We have a document assembly program, which I actually designed, it's based on hot docs, but I wrote the logical statement, the code that takes our forms and turns them into automated documents with lots and lots of help screens. It turns drafting into an educational process, which helps because you don't have the time to mentor and teach young associates that you used to have. They really do have to learn on the job, and it's helpful if they can have some software that makes drafting a learning experience. It helps to prevent any real disasters in drafting, and it helps the old men and women who are drafting these days still to do it right and to stay abreast of developments. It's been, I think, a key sort of productivity tool to keep us going in this demographically altered world of the Trust and Estates Department. But I don't know if our experiences, I'm going to be interested in whether others share these perceptions or not.
And Josh?
I actually don't necessarily share those experiences. I think that there's been a turnaround in the last 5 or 6 years maybe, as the financial sector has entirely realigned itself into wealth management groups. Law firms are always slow to do everything, and I think there's probably a good 20 to 25 year period where trusts and estates fell out of favor with firms. But I'm seeing an increasing interest in people who've come out of law school in the last 3, 4, 5 years of getting into trusts and estates, because that's wealth management is where all the big financial companies are redeploying their own efforts. And I think one of the reasons why everybody in this room is as busy as he or she is that there just haven't been enough people doing it. But in our summer, now we happen to have a very large trust and estates department, but the problem that we have in our firm is that if we have 20 kids in our kids, that's not fair, in our summer program, 8 of them want to do trusts and estates at the end of the summer, and we can't accommodate more than 1 or 2. And that didn't used to be the case. So I think maybe it is turning around.
So maybe the premise of the question is wrong. And that's I certainly agree that the move towards wealth management bodes well for sort of getting T&E back into the mainstream where the action is. But we continue to experience difficulty in attracting first-rate associates.
We've been fortunate in the last couple of years, like Josh, we're experiencing too much demand, actually. But it's historically it's coming in waves, and I think we should enjoy the good times and bone up on the technology for the bad times.
Mr. Rubenstein, are you recommending trusts to your clients? Why? Does the size of the estate matter? Along the same lines, are your clients interested in protecting gifts and inheritances from their children's creditors and future spouses? If so, what do you recommend to provide that protection?
I'm standing between you and the alcoholic beverage of your choice, so I will try to do this quickly. I actually think that trusts are more useful than ever and more intriguing than ever, and I'm beginning to notice a kind of a sea change with clients who I always thought I know some people have always drafted with a predilection towards lifetime trusts, but most of my clients used to say, what they haven't learned by the age of 40, they're never going to learn. So they would use short-term trusts, but not long-term trusts. And I'm seeing that change a lot. I don't know if the world is a more uncertain place than it used to be. Maybe it is. But there's been so much change recently that, I mean, this question will go full circle to the first question, which is, what do you do in uncertain times? Trusts are so flexible to plan for uncertain times. If you give it to somebody, you're stuck with it, and then if you're in a high-tax regime, it's hard to get rid of. Whereas if you give it to them in trust, it may protect them from taxes if there is a tax regime. If you have broad invasion standards, you can get it out of trust if it wasn't turned out not to have been necessary. But you can't get it back into the bottle once it's out. So I find for tax purposes, look, still GRATs and QPERTs and things like that are the best way I can think of moving large amounts of appreciation out entirely gift tax free. Keeping them in trusts for protracted periods of time avoids estate tax, avoids GST tax. Making them grantor trusts during the grantor's life is just a gimme. That'll probably be legislated out at some point because it makes no sense. So you've got all those great tax reasons to do trusts. And then a whole bunch of non-tax reasons. The fact of creditors. People are just very, very worried about creditors these days. The world has become a much more litigious place. Marital rights. As people have accumulated much more wealth, young people getting married for the first time still have no greater desire than they ever did before to have prenups. And how many times have your clients said to you, how do I force my son or daughter to do a prenup? Well, you can't. Your alternative is to put it in trust for a long period of time. We're all living longer. Periods of protracted incapacity can be addressed by trusts. Choice of law provisions. Our laws keep on changing. Maybe you don't like the law in the state where you live. If you did this just under your will, you don't have the option of picking laws. Whereas if you put them in trust, you can pick the laws. You know better than everybody else, and you want to control the ultimate disposition of the property. You can do that through a trust. And finally, as families get larger and you go down more and more generations, but you have assets that really require unified control, the trust is a very flexible vehicle for that. So, I mean, the obvious example is vacation homes, which now have to be shared by 64 second cousins. But, what about copyrights and royalties? I mean, if you let that go outright, as it would normally go under the copyright laws, which follow an inheritance pattern, how do you exploit a copyright where you need the consent of 16 different people? If you leave them in a trust, which has all those different beneficiaries as beneficiaries of it, but one trustee who has the right to promote and exploit copyrights, any intellectual property type of right, that's really the way to go for complicated assets that require unified management. So I think the trust is alive and well and a great vehicle of choice. I just will point out, going back to Anne's topic of the world becoming a smaller place, it's only common law countries that really have a concept of trusts. Civil law countries are starting to. Italy has trust legislation, but most civil law countries don't even know what a trust is, and it's very erratic how it will be treated. And the mother of all trusts, England, doesn't respect trusts for marital purposes. So whereas if you put a property in trust, it will be outside of equitable distribution in the United States, that is not the case in the UK, where they don't respect trusts for divorce and they don't respect prenuptial agreements. So the world is different. Be careful where you go.
The question is, for the wealthiest clients, do you recommend that they make taxable gifts?
Are they Democrats or Republicans? I think, is a question of full disclosure. And the client's appetite, obviously, if you believe the estate tax is going to stay and that the rate is not going to go down significantly, there are benefits still to be realized from making gifts and paying estate tax and paying gift tax in order to avoid estate tax on the appreciation and earnings over the balance of the donor's lifetime. But those are a couple of very large ifs, and many clients just don't have the appetite for paying, writing out the check for the gift tax. And many others feel that right now they're going to feel like really idiots, or they're going to fire you if 5 years from now there's a decrease in the estate tax rate. The I think the thing that really limits this is for the wealthiest clients, it's just plain too expensive to make taxable gifts, so that for them, primarily, you're going to be relying on giving away upside at little or no gift tax cost rather than the brute force approach.
This recording of the Future Vision of Estate Planning is copyrighted by Wilmington Trust Corporation and used with Wilmington Trust's permission. Further reproduction without permission is prohibited. Lineberg Information Services, Inc., Lizzie, is deeply appreciative and would like to particularly thank Dick Neno, Managing Director and Trust Counsel at Wilmington Trust, for allowing Lizzie to record and share this most important seminar.